but it feels just like home. Yours, Sugar. The woman hanging on the end of the line. Dear Sugar, I need your help with forgiveness. I'm carrying a fierce anger in my body every day, and I can't seem to find my way out of it. Last year, I discovered that my husband and a young woman I hired were having a relationship. This woman, who I'd invited into my life, who I'd helped with her career, who I'd invited into my family, responded by meeting secretly with my husband and writing him histrionic love letters, pressuring him to leave me. My whole view of the world has gone dim. People are capable of the most astonishing and selfish acts. I used to focus on pursuing real joy and delight in my life, and sharing that joy too. But now it feels like that light has gone out forever. This woman has caused damage in my family that I never imagined possible. I know it harms me to say so, but I really, really hate her. Recently, I discovered that she is still writing my husband letters, some 6 months after he broke it off. I have a white ball of rage about it, a monster in my chest. I imagine terrible fates befalling her, and that consumes me every day. How do I find my way back to compassion and the joyful life I once had? Can I find even a little shred of peace? Mourning and Raging. Dear Mourning and Raging, how painful. I'm sorry this happened to you. There are few things more devastating than a betrayal such as the sort you describe. It's no wonder you have a mega-hot white monster ball raging inside of you. It's a reasonable response to a hurtful situation. And yet, as you know, you'll only destroy yourself if you continue to allow your rage to consume you. So let's talk about how you might find some peace. Your letter implies that you and your husband have stayed together through this turmoil. You didn't ask for marital advice, so I'll refrain from giving it. But I'd be remiss if I didn't say that I think a huge chunk of your other woman fury will be diffused once you and your husband repair the damage his affair has caused. What strikes me most about your letter is how little you say about him. Your rage appears to be directed solely toward the woman with whom he had an affair. You write that she has, quote, caused damage in my family that I never imagined possible. But of course, she couldn't have caused damage if your husband hadn't let her. They both violated your trust, but your husband committed the graver offense. He took a vow. She only took a job. I don't point this out in order to dismiss her transgression, but rather to call your attention to a dynamic that's worth examining. To have a covert love affair with one member of the couple who employs you is bad form indeed. But why is your rage focused on her rather than him? Is it possible that you've subconsciously redirected your anger to the safer party, since hating her doesn't require you to dismantle your life, as hating him would? How did you express your anger toward your husband when you learned of the affair? How did you forgive him? Did your rage toward the other woman increase or decrease after you forgave your husband? Why? What does forgiveness in this context mean to you? I encourage you to spend some time reflecting on these questions. Answering them may restore at least some sense of balance regarding your rage, and it will also require you to contemplate core issues that must be resolved before you'll be able to find the joyful life again. When bad things happen, often the only way back to wholeness is to take it all apart. You have the strength to do that, no matter how marriage-mucking and soul-shaking that will be. A terrible thing happened to you, but you mustn't let it define your life. Couples survive all kinds of shit, including shit like this. And individuals survive too, even when their marriages don't. There is a way forward. You asked for help with forgiveness, but I don't think that's what you need to reach for just yet. You know how alcoholics who go to AA are always using that phrase, one day at a time? They say that because to say, I will never drink again, is just too damn much. It's big and hard and bound to fail. This is how forgiveness feels for you at this moment, no doubt. It's the reason you can't do it. I suggest you forget about forgiveness for now and strive for acceptance instead. Accept that the man you love was unfaithful to you. Accept that a woman you once held in regard treated you with disrespect. Accept that their actions hurt you deeply. Accept that this experience taught you something you didn't want to know. Accept that sorrow and strife are part of even a joyful life. Accept that it's going to take a long time for you to get that monster out of your chest. Accept that someday what pains you now will surely pain you less. Just writing that to you makes me feel better, mourning and raging. Do you feel the shift? Acceptance has everything to do with simplicity, with sitting in the ordinary place, with bearing witness to the plain facts of our life, with not just starting at the essential, but ending up there. Your life has been profoundly shaken by these recent revelations. It's not your task to immediately forgive those who shook you. Your spoken desire to forgive the woman who betrayed you is in opposition to what you feel. Forgiveness forces an impossible internal face-off between you and a woman you hate. Acceptance asks only that you embrace what's true. Strange as it sounds, I don't think you've done that yet. I can hear it in the pitch of your letter. You're so outraged and surprised that this shitty thing happened to you that there's a piece of you that isn't yet convinced it did. You're looking for the explanation, the loophole, the bright twist in the dark tale that reverses its course. Anyone would be. It's the reason I've had to narrate my own stories of injustice about 7,000 times. As if by raging about it once more, the story will change, and by the end of it, I won't still be the woman hanging on the end of the line. But it won't change. For me, or for you, or for anyone who has ever been wronged, which is everyone. We are all at some point, and usually at many points over the course of a life, the woman hanging on the end of the line. Allow your acceptance of that to be a transformative experience. You do that by simply looking it square in the face and then moving on. You don't have to move fast or far. You can just go an inch. You can mark your progress breath by breath. Literally. And it's there that I recommend you begin. Every time you think, I hate that fucking bitch, I want you to neutralize that thought with a breath. Calm your mind, breathe in deeply with intention, then breathe out. Do not think, I hate that fucking bitch, while you do it. Give yourself that. Blow that bitch right out of your chest, then move on to something else. I have breathed my way through so many people who I felt wronged by, through so many situations I couldn't change. Sometimes while doing this, I have breathed in acceptance and breathed out love. Sometimes I've breathed in gratitude and out forgiveness. Sometimes I haven't been able to muster anything beyond the breath itself, my mind forced blank with nothing but the desire to be free of sorrow and rage. It works. And the reason it works is the salve is being applied directly to the wound. It's not a coincidence that you describe your pain as being lodged in your chest. When you breathe with calm intention, you're zapping the white rage monster precisely where it lives. You're cutting off its feeding tube and forcing a new thought into your head, one that nurtures rather than tortures you. It's essentially mental self-discipline. I'm not suggesting one deny negative emotions, but rather that you accept them and move through them by embracing the power we have to keep from wallowing in emotions that don't serve us well. It's hard work. It's important work. I believe something like forgiveness is on the other side. You will get there, dear woman. Just try. Yours, Sugar. No mystery about sperm. Dear Sugar, I'm a woman in my late 30s and still single. I never imagined this would be me at this age. I've had several relationships where I thought I'd found the one, only to have the rug pulled out from under me. The most devastating of these ended about 5 years ago, at the age when most of my friends were getting married or having babies. My boyfriend of 3 years, with whom I lived, was divorced with a child. He abruptly decided to go back to his ex-wife just as we were looking to buy a house. This was after he had spent a fair amount of time in therapy at the beginning of our relationship to reach the conclusion that he was certain he wanted to build a life with me and have children with me. What a fool I was. When he left me, he assured me that it was only for his child, who was struggling, and that I was still his true love, and he knew that once she was off to college, he would come back and we'd live happily ever after. She was 8. Apparently, I was supposed to wait 10 years, getting old, while he finished up his other life. I spent a couple of years wrecked and jaded over that relationship. I pulled myself together as best I could and dated a few people casually. Last year, I met someone I connected with. Unfortunately, he was even more jaded than I, and he didn't want to take a leap of faith with me. We split up a couple of months ago. So now I find myself watching the end of my fertility looming. I always wanted to experience pregnancy and birth. I'm now considering becoming a single mom. I'm not even sure I know how to go about that, but I'm aware that time is running out, and even though I would prefer to raise a child with a partner, I don't have much faith in that happening anymore. Even if I met someone now, he'd pretty much have to want to have a baby right away, and that's not likely. Yet I'm struggling with letting go of the idea that I will find love and have a baby with a partner. I'm paralyzed. It's hard to let that dream go. If I take this step, I'm deciding definitively that I will not get married and have a child like I watched most of my friends do. Did I mention the burning jealousy every time I see their happy family pictures on Facebook? The photos from the hospital where mommy smiles with baby on chest? The congratulations I write, accompanied by a feeling like I've been sucker punched? How can I move forward and let go of that dream? Should I start calling sperm banks? I just can't believe that this is how my story ends. Signed, M. Dear M, I'm of the opinion that there are some things one should never advise another to do. Marry someone in particular? Not marry someone in particular? Pierce one's clitoris or cock, oil one's body, and run around naked at a party wearing a homemade Alice B. Toklas mask, and have a baby. And yet, I cannot help but say that it seems apparent to me that you should seriously consider having a baby. Not because I want you to, but because you want to. Oh, the dream. The goddamn man plus baby dream. Written by the High Commission on Heterosexual Love and Sexual Reproduction, and practiced by couples across the land. The dream's a bitch if you're a maternally inclined straight female and not living it by the age of 37. A situation of a spermicidally toxic flavor. Of course you want to bring out your six shooter every time you see another bloated mom hoisting up another pinched-faced spawn on Facebook. You want the dream too. But M, you didn't get it. Not yet. Not quite ever, perhaps. That doesn't mean all is lost. This is not, quote, how your story ends. It's simply where it takes a turn you didn't expect. I don't mean to downplay your sorrow. Your disappointment is justified. Your paralysis, understandable. Your conundrum, real. But please remember that the dream you have of finding a long-term romantic partner and having a baby is not just one dream. It's two. The partner dream and the baby dream are so intricately woven that you can be forgiven for thinking they're one. It's lovely if it is rolled up into one. It's more than lovely. It's convenient. It's conventional. It's economically advantageous. It's hella good when it's good. But it isn't what you have. So let's see what you've got. You have the strong desire to be a mother by biological means, coupled with a deep regret that you aren't currently involved with a man with whom to reproduce. The only thing you need to make a biological baby of your own is sperm and luck. Getting sperm does not mean that you are, quote, deciding definitively that you will not get married and have a child. Life is long, darling. Who knows what's going to happen? You could meet your big love tomorrow. You could meet him in 10 years. You could have a baby on your own now and another with him when you're 42. You don't know. The question about who you will love and when you will love him is out of your hands. It's a mystery that you can't solve. There is, however, no mystery about sperm. There are vials to be had at banks for purchase. There are possibly friends or acquaintances willing to give you some for free. The time to answer your question about whether you want to try to conceive a baby on your own is upon you. The window of your reproductive viability will soon close. I agree with you that you've reached the point that it's reasonable to assume that your choice is between having a baby without a partner or having no biological baby at all. Which scenario makes you sadder? Which are you going to be happy you did when you're 50? It's time to do the emotional and practical work you need to do so you can make a decision. The website of the organization Single Mothers by Choice is an excellent place to start. I can't tell you what to do. No one can. But as the mother of two children, I can tell you what most moms will. That mothering is absurdly hard and profoundly sweet. Like the best thing you ever did. Like if you think you want to have a baby, you probably should. I say this in spite of the fact that children are giant, endless suck machines. They don't give a whit if you need to sleep or eat or pee or get your work done or go out to a party naked and oiled up in a homemade Alice B. Toklas mask. They take everything. They will bring you to the furthest edge of your personality and abso-fucking-lutely to your knees. They will also give you everything back. Not just all they take, but many of the things you lost before they came along as well. Every mother has a different story, though we tend to group them together. We like to think that partnered moms have it good and single moms have it rough, but the truth is, we're a diverse bunch. Some single mothers have lots of child-free time because their kids are regularly in the custody of their fathers. Some seldom get a break. Some partnered mothers split childcare duties with their spouses in egalitarian ways. Others might as well be alone. Some mothers of both varieties have parents, siblings, and friends who play active roles in their children's lives in ways that significantly lighten the load. Others have to pay for every hour another person looks after their kids. Some mothers, single or partnered, can afford to pay anyone for anything. Some can and do. Others can and won't. Some are aided financially by parents or trust funds or inheritances. Others are entirely on their own. The reality is that regardless of the circumstances, most moms are alternately blissed out by their love for their children and utterly overwhelmed by the spectacular amount of sacrifice they require. What you must answer when you delve into this question about whether to have a baby alone, honey bun, is what the landscape will look like for you. Not what it looks like for single mothers by choice, but how it will actually play out in your own life. How will you need to restructure or reconsider your life if you become a mother? What resources do you have? What resources will you need? And how will you get them? Knowing what I know about having babies, three of the four big questions I'd have if I were considering parenting a child without a partner are surprisingly the same questions I asked myself when I, with my partner, pondered having a baby. They were, 1, how the hell am I going to pay for this? 2, who the hell is going to take care of the baby so I can work? And 3, will I ever have sex again? So let's start with those. You don't mention financial matters in your letter, but I presume you have to earn a living. Kids cost a fortune, especially if you have to pay someone to take care of them so you can work. My kids are now 4 and 6. Preschool tuition over the past few years has nearly bankrupted Mr. Sugar and me. Literally. When our kids were babies, we hired a part-time nanny and juggled childcare between us the rest of the time. We both make our living as artists, so neither one of us has what's called a, quote, real job. The nanny cost us $15 an hour. We hired her for 20 hours a week. When the nanny came, my husband and I would go into our shared office in the basement and ignore each other so we could each do our thing, at which point our children would invariably settle down for a long nap, strangely able to discern when we were paying someone else to look after them. Every hour that passed, I'd think, did I make $15? Did I even make $7.50? Often enough, the answer was no, which is a long way of saying that questions number 1 and number 2 are inextricably bound. More so than the man plus baby high commission on heterosexual love and sexual reproduction dream. Especially for you, since you'll be the sole breadwinner. Many partners are great for watching the baby while you work or shower or make phone calls that go better if a small beast is not shrieking in the background. You won't have one, the partner, that is. You'll have only the small shrieking beast. What will you do? Do you have any support in the way of free childcare? Do not believe all the sweet friends who say, "Oh, Em, have a baby. I'll totally help you with the baby. I'll be like the baby's auntie." Those people have good intentions, but most of them are bon vivants who will not take your baby. Or they might take your baby once when it's spring and they get the urge to go to the zoo because they want to see the elephants. You need someone to take your baby every Monday and Wednesday and Friday from 9 to 3. One thing I've learned since becoming a mother is that most adults aren't willing to spend much time with other people's children unless there is some direct benefit to them, namely money or the promise that you will someday return the favor and take their children. There are, of course, exceptions. Some grandparents long to play a significant part in the lives of their grandchildren. Do you have an essentially sane, remotely physically fit, non-daytime drinking, baby-loving parent or two who lives nearby? A sibling or friend who genuinely wants to commit to pitching in? If you don't have that sort of support, what will you do for childcare? And how will you structure it? And how will you pay for it? Next, we come to the question of whether your post-child life will be a dreary, sexless hell. There will probably not be too much action for a while, but worry not. This has little to do with your partnerless status. Mr. Sugar and I joke that the only reason we opted to have our second child was so we'd have sex at least one more time before we died. You'll be exhausted, hormonally altered, and perhaps vaginally or abdominally maimed by the baby, and thus not thinking about sex for a while. But eventually, you'll come around and be interested in dating again. Some men won't be interested in dating you because you have a baby. Others will be fine with the baby, and you'll date them, and maybe one of them will turn out to be the one. Regardless of what happens with the men, you'll have a baby, an amazing little being who will blow your mind and expand your heart and make you think things you never thought and remember things you believed you forgot and heal things you imagined would never heal and forgive people you've begrudged for too long. And understand things you didn't understand before you fell madly in love with a tiny tyrant who doesn't give a damn whether you need to pee. You will sing again if you stop singing. You will dance again if you stop dancing. You will crawl around on the floor and play chase and tickle and peekaboo. You'll make towers of teetering blocks and snakes and rabbits with clay. It's an altogether cool thing. And it will be lonely, too. Doing all that without a partner? How lonely, I can't say. You will hold your baby and cry sometimes in frustration, in rage, in despair, in exhaustion, and inexplicable sorrow. You will watch your baby with joy and laugh at the wonder so pure and the beauty so unconcealed that it will make you ache. These are the times when it's really nice to have a partner, Em. What will you do? How will you fill the place where the man you've been holding out for would have been? That is your hard question for me, the one I didn't ask myself when I decided to get pregnant and become a mother, though of course it was naive for me to think I didn't have to. Not a single one of us knows what the future holds. The unexpected happens even when we've got everything mapped out. My friend A lost her husband in a car crash 4 days before her daughter was born. My friend B's husband died of cancer when their son wasn't yet 2. My friend C's husband left her for another woman when their baby was 6 weeks old. My friend D's partner decided he wasn't all that into being a dad, and a few months after his child was born, moved across the country. I could go on. I could work my way all the way down the alphabet. Even if you get the dream, you don't know if it will stay true. It works in reverse, too. What you fear might not come to pass. You might decide to have your baby and find true love in the midst of that. You might search your soul and realize that you don't want a baby after all, not if it means going it without a man. What's important is that you make the leap. Jump high and hard with intention and heart. Pay no mind to the vision the commission made up. It's up to you to make your life. Take what you have and stack it up like a tower of teetering blocks. Build your dream around that. Yours, Sugar. The Mad Sex Confessor. Dear Sugar, my elderly father is coming to live with me in a few months. My mother passed away about 3 years ago. My father is going to be living with all the rest of my siblings as well. He'll move from one place to the next every 4 or 5 months. He enjoys traveling, so we thought moving him around would make him feel more active and independent. I hesitate to say that I am my father's favorite, since I do not particularly relish the idea of that, nor has he ever been a demonstrative or involved parent. But I will say that he depends on me slightly more than he depends on my other brothers and sisters. Recently, that has become an emotional dependence as well. Sugar, my father has begun confessing to me. At first, these weird confessions were small and insignificant, and I chalked them up to the fact that he was feeling his own mortality and therefore taking stock of his life. But more recently, his confessions have turned into a crimes and misdemeanors festival that's not fun for me at all. He's been telling me about the many women he cheated on my mother with, about how he isn't 100% certain that he hasn't fathered other children, and tawdry sexual details that spawn visuals I do not want to have. He told me that when my mom got pregnant with me, she didn't want a fifth child, so she wanted to abort me, but feared someone might find out, so she canceled the appointment but cut him off sex, which led to his first affair. This is not information I ever needed to know. I'm a forgiving person, Sugar, but here's the kicker. He isn't sorry. I mean, I might be able to take all this new, hideous information, like he was fucking the housekeeper in the 80s, for example, if he showed a drop of remorse. But he has none. He claims that he's telling me and not my siblings because he knew I, quote, won't judge him. What the hell gave him that idea? As warped as it is, I recognize it as his attempt to bond with me. That being said, I would like him to shut up now. I suddenly don't know how I feel about him living with me and spouting off this bullshit every day. I'm not sure what to do. I feel that it's my responsibility to care for him, but am I allowed to establish boundaries this late in the game? Trustee. Dear Trustee, yes, you are allowed to establish boundaries this late in the game. In fact, this would be a good idea even if your father hadn't become an unfortunate font of naughty narratives. An elderly parent moving in with an adult child is a major life transition for both the parties, and in some cases, the adult child's spouse and children as well. Even in the best of circumstances, it's wise to map out a family plan in which ground rules and expectations are stated, concerns are discussed, and a plan for conflict resolution is agreed upon. When two households merge, roles of authority and responsibility must be rearranged, sometimes subtly, sometimes drastically. And they must be rearranged in a way that often reverses the long-established parent-child order. This is unquestionably a complicated thing. That your father has chosen to further complicate it by becoming the mad sex confessor is no fun at all. I encourage you to simplify it immediately by telling him you do not want to hear another word about his sex life. Be clear, be direct, be unwavering. If he doesn't respect your wishes, cut him off at the quick. If he begins to speak of such things, tell him to stop. If he won't stop, walk out of the room or pull over to the side of the road or do whatever it takes to remove yourself from his company. If you're firm and consistent, he'll eventually get the point. Once you've established this boundary, I encourage you to explore the underlying issues that may be compelling your father to speak to you so inappropriately. There's a chance that his confessions are connected to a medical condition. Some diseases of the brain cause personality changes. If you think there's even a chance this could be the case, and especially if you observe other changes in your father, I suggest you consult with his doctor. A more likely scenario is what you suppose. These confessions are your father's warped way of bonding with you. Perhaps the best way to get him to stop telling you what you don't want to hear is to ask him about what you're willing to listen to. Maybe he simply needs to finally open up about his life to someone he loves. Why not try to engage him on a deeper level? Ask him to share with you other stories of his life, The ones that he's never been brave enough to tell. Surely he's got some that don't involve humping the housekeeper while your mother went to the grocery store. For this, for both of you, I'll hope. Yours, Sugar. The future has an ancient heart. Dear Sugar, I teach creative writing at the University of Alabama, where the majority of my students are seniors graduating soon. Most of them are English and creative writing majors or minors, who are feeling a great deal of dread and anxiety about their expulsion from academia and their entry into the real world. Many of their friends in other disciplines have already lined up postgraduate jobs, and many of my students are tired of the "being an English major prepares you for law school" comments being made by friends and family alike, who are pressuring them toward a career in law despite having little or no interest in it. I've been reading your columns to my students in an attempt to pep them up and let them know that everything is going to be all right. Our school has decided to forgo a graduation speaker for the last 5 years or so. And even when we did have a graduation speaker, often they were leaders in business or former athletes. And so their message was lost on the ears of the majority of 21 and 22-year-olds. So, Sugar, I'm asking you to deliver a graduation speech for our little class of writers. While we might have difficulty obtaining you an honorary PhD, believe me when I say that among us are some extremely talented writers, bakers, musicians, editors, designers, and video game players who will gladly write you a lyric essay, bake you a pie, write you a song, and perform countless other acts of kindness in exchange for your advice. Fondly, Cupcake and Team 408. Dear Cupcake and Team 408, there's a line by the Italian writer Carlo Levi that I think is apt here. The future has an ancient heart. I love it because it expresses with such grace and economy what is certainly true, that who we become is born of who we most primitively are, that we both know and cannot possibly know what it is we've yet to make manifest in our lives. I think it's a useful sentiment for you to reflect upon now, sweet peas, at this moment when the future likely feels like the opposite of ancient, when instead it feels like a Lamborghini that's pulled up to the curb while every voice around demands you get in and drive. I'm here to tell you it's okay to travel by foot. In fact, I recommend it. There is so much ahead that's worth seeing, so much behind you can't identify at top speed. Your teacher is correct. You're going to be all right. And you're going to be all right not because you majored in English or didn't, and not because you plan to apply to law school or don't, but because all right is almost always where we eventually land, even if we fuck up entirely along the way. I know. I fucked up some things. I was an English major, too. As it happens, I lied for 6 years about having an English degree, though I didn't exactly mean to lie. I had gone to college and participated in a graduation ceremony. I'd walked across the stage and collected a paper baton. On that paper, it said a bachelor's degree would be mine once I finished one final class. It seemed like such an easy thing to do, but it wasn't. And so I didn't do it, and the years slipped past, each one making it seem more unlikely that I'd ever get my degree. I'd done all the coursework except that one class. I'd gotten good grades. To claim that I had an English degree was truer than not, I told myself. But that didn't make it true. You have to do what you have to do. There's absolutely nothing wrong with law school, but don't go unless you want to be a lawyer. You can't take a class if taking a class feels like it's going to kill you. Faking it never works. If you don't believe me, read Richard Wright. Read Charlotte Bronte. Read Joy Harjo. Read Toni Morrison. Read William Trevor. Read the entire Western canon. Or just close your eyes and remember everything you already know. Let whatever mysterious starlight that guided you this far guide you onward into whatever crazy beauty awaits. Trust that all you learned during your college years was worth learning, no matter what answer you have or do not have about what use it is. Know that all those stories, poems, plays, and novels are a part of you now, and they are bigger than you, and they will always be. I was a waitress during most of the years that I didn't have my English degree. My mother had been a waitress for many of the years that she was raising my siblings and me. She loved to read. She always wanted to go to college. One time she took a night class when I was very young, and my father became enraged with her and cut her textbook into pieces with a pair of scissors. She dropped the class. I think it was biology. You don't have to get a job that makes others feel comfortable about what they perceive as your success. You don't have to explain what you plan to do with your life. You don't have to justify your education by demonstrating its financial rewards. You don't have to maintain an impeccable credit score. Anyone who expects you to do any of those things has no sense of history or economics or science or the arts. You have to pay your own electric bill. You have to be kind. You have to give it all you got. You have to find people who love you truly and love them back with the same truth. But that's all. I got married when I was in college. I got divorced during the years that I was lying about having an English degree. When I met the man to whom I am now married, he said, "You know, I really think you should finish your degree. Not because I want you to, but because I can tell that you want to." I thought he was sort of being an asshole. We didn't bring up the subject again for a year. I understand what you're afraid of. I understand what your parents fear. There are practical concerns. One needs money to live. And then there is a deep longing to feel legitimate in the world, to feel that others hold us in regard. I felt intermittently ashamed during my years as a waitress. In my family, I was supposed to be the one who made it. At times it seemed instead I had squandered my education and dishonored my dead mother by becoming a waitress like her. Sometimes I would think of this as I went from table to table with my tray, and I'd have to think of something else so I wouldn't cry. Years after I no longer worked at the last restaurant where I waited tables, my first novel was published. The man who'd been my manager at the restaurant read about me in the newspaper and came to my reading. He'd often been rude and snappish with me, and I despised him on occasion. But I was touched to see him in the bookstore that night. "All those years ago, who would have guessed we'd be here celebrating the publication of your novel?" he asked when we embraced. "I would have," I replied. And it was true. I always would have guessed it, even all the time that I feared it would never happen. Being there that night was the meaning of my life. Getting there had been my every intention. When I say you don't have to explain what you're going to do with your life, I'm not suggesting you lounge around whining about how difficult it is. I'm suggesting you apply yourself in directions for which we have no accurate measurement. I'm talking about work and love. It's really condescending to tell you how young you are. It's even inaccurate. Some of you who are graduating from college are not young. Some of you are older than me. But to those of you new college graduates who are indeed young, the old new college graduates will back me up on this. You are so goddamn young. Which means about 8 of the 10 things you have decided about yourself will over time prove to be false. The other 2 things will prove to be so true that you'll look back in 20 years and howl. My mother was young too, but not like those of you who are so goddamned young. She was 40 when she finally went to college. She spent the last years of her life as a college student, though she didn't know they were her last years. She thought she was at the beginning of the next era of her life. She died a couple of months before we were both supposed to graduate from different schools. At her memorial service, my mother's favorite professor stood up and granted her an honorary PhD. The most terrible and beautiful and interesting things happen in a life. For some of you, those things have already happened. Whatever happens to you belongs to you. Make it yours. Feed it to yourself, even if it feels impossible to swallow. Let it nurture you, because it will. I have learned this over and over and over again. There came a day when I decided to stop lying. I called the college from which I did not have an English degree and asked the woman who answered the phone what I needed to do to get one. She told me I had only to take one class. It could be any class. I chose Latin. I'd never studied Latin, but I wanted to know at last where so many of our words come from. I had a romantic idea of what it would be like to study Latin. The Romance languages are, after all, descended from it. But it wasn't romantic. It was a lot of confusion and memorization and attempting to decipher bizarre stories about soldiers marching around ancient lands. In spite of my best efforts, I got a B. One thing I never forgot from my Latin class is that a language that is descended from another language is called a daughter language. It was the beginning of the next era of my life, like this is of yours. Years after I no longer lived in the state where my mother and I went to college, I traveled to that state to give a reading for my first novel. Just as my former boss had done in a different city mere weeks before, the professor who'd granted my mother a PhD at her memorial service read about me in the newspaper and came to the bookstore to hear me read. All those years ago, who would have guessed we'd be here celebrating the publication of your novel, she asked when we embraced. Not me, I replied. Not me. And it was true. I meant it as sincerely as I'd meant that I always would have guessed it when I'd been speaking to my boss. That both things could be true at once, my disbelief as well as my certainty, was the unification of the ancient and the future parts of me. It was everything I intended, and yet still I was surprised by what I got. I hope you will be surprised and knowing at once. I hope you'll always have love. I hope you'll have days of ease and a good sense of humor. I hope one of you really will bake me a pie. Banana cream, please. I hope when people ask what you're going to do with your English and or creative writing degree, you'll say, continue my bookish examination of the contradictions and complexities of human motivation and desire. Or maybe just carry it with me as I do everything that matters. And then smile very serenely until they say, oh, yours, sugar. Faux friendship footsie. Dear sugar, I may be in love with my friend. He may be in love with me. At the very least, we love each other's company. We see each other every day, talk on the phone at least two or three times a day, and miss each other when we have to say goodbye. There's a high degree of sexual tension that quickly manifested in our friendship, which we tried to control by talking honestly to one another about it and discussing the reason it can't come to fruition. He's in a serious monogamous relationship with a kind, beautiful, loving woman that I also consider a friend. At first, we tried to brush off the mutual attraction as natural. We both find each other physically attractive. Whether it's natural or not, there were nights when it seemed unbearable not to touch, so we decided we should spend time apart. But attempting to stay apart only amplified how much we'd come to rely on each other. We'd only get a few hours into the day before one of us called the other. Then we tried to see each other only when his girlfriend was included as well. Horrifyingly, her presence didn't dispel the tension. It just made me feel guiltier. We've never kissed. We've never crossed a physical boundary. But something is happening. He's not going to leave her, at least not right now, nor would I ask him to. As strongly as I may feel about him, I recognize they do genuinely love each other. We're not going to have an affair, as it would only end badly for everyone. We're probably not going to stop seeing one another. We've tried for the last 2 months and can't seem to make that happen. We are trying very, very hard to keep things platonic, but it shouldn't be this hard. If we'd met at a different time, we'd probably be lovers. My friend is brilliant, but never condescending, Kind, generous, talented, passionate, interesting, charming, funny, and warm. We spend hours talking. We're never bored. We can't stop smiling around each other. We really like each other. Our friendship means everything to me and him, but it's not going to survive if we don't find a way to curtail the lust that only seems to grow stronger. What do I do, Sugar? I love him. I respect and admire his girlfriend, and I want to do right by everyone. More than anything else, I want us to stay friends. So why doesn't that seem to be working? The Friend. Dear The Friend, it doesn't seem to be working because you aren't really friends with this man. You're having a sexually repressed, mildly deceitful, romantic relationship with him. You're dry dating, and this particular version of dry dating sucks and will continue to suck until A, your friend breaks up with his girlfriend so the two of you can explore your feelings for each other without being lying jackasses, or B, the two of you embrace the fact that we are all lying jackasses sometimes, and you have an affair that includes sex, and not just the emotional affair you are so obviously having, so that you can see if this tension between you has a life beyond the don't touch, don't tell policy you've so achingly adopted. Or C, you break off your relationship with your friend because you are falling in love with him, and he is unavailable. A is out because you have no control over whether your friend will break up with his girlfriend. B is out because you've already established wisely that you don't want to be a lying jackass, fun as that may be for a while. But C is all yours, mi amiga, and from Sugar's candy sweet vantage point, it is so very crystal clear that it's what you need to do. C is not fun. At first glance, parting ways with your seriously cool, smoking hot, but oh so very attached wonder boy seems like the worst idea of all. But trust me when I say that it's the only route to get what you believe you want, which is him. But it's all of him. Not him on the sly. Not him as a, quote, friend you want to sleep with, but can't, and don't, and won't. To get what you want in a romantic relationship, you must say what you want. Shall we say it together? You want your friend to be free to fall in love with you for real, if you are really going to fall in love. This tortured, half-assed, overheated game of faux friendship footsie the two of you are playing simply won't do. Maybe your decision to cut your friend loose will make it clear to him that he wants to explore what's possible with you, and he'll do what needs to be done in his own life so you can. Maybe it will make it clear to him that losing a woman he loves in order to openly explore what's possible with you is too high of a price to pay. Either way, dear friend, you win. Yours, Sugar. The Human Scale. Dear Sugar, I'm writing this from my little couch bed in the pediatric intensive care unit at Eggleston Children's Hospital in Atlanta. My husband and I just found out that our 6-month-old daughter, Emma, has a tumor, and she's having brain surgery tomorrow. I'm scared that I will lose her. I'm scared she could be paralyzed, or her development will be messed up, and she will have a hard life. I'm scared they will find out the tumor is cancerous, and she will need chemo. She's only a little baby. People have poured all their thoughts and prayers into us right now, but to be honest, God is farthest from my mind. I've never been super religious, but now I find myself doubting his existence more than ever. If there were a God, why would he let my little girl have to have possibly life-threatening surgery, Sugar? I never in a million years thought that my husband and I would be in this situation. I want to ask you to pray, and all your readers to pray, to a God maybe I'm not sure I even believe in anymore. Pray that my baby will be okay, and that we can walk away from this and forget it ever happened. I have written you before about different things which now seem so stupid and silly. I just want to get through this with my husband and daughter and look back and thank God that everything is okay. I want to believe in him, and I want to believe all the prayers being said for us are working. Abby. Dear Abby, I have been thinking of you and Emma and your husband nonstop since I read your email. Please know I'm holding you in my deepest thoughts and wishing the best for Emma. I would like to publish your letter and my reply, but I want to be sure you sent it to me with that intent. If you didn't, if you meant it as a personal email to me, that's fine, and I won't publish it. If you do want me to publish it, I want to make sure you're okay with including the identifying details, Emma's name, the name of the hospital, and such. If not, let me know, and either you or I can alter those details. Sending you love, light, blessings, strength. Love, Sugar. Dear Sugar, thank you so much for replying. I would love for you to publish my letter. If you would like, you can also add this part to let everyone know that the surgery went well. The doctors think the tumor is benign. They had to leave one small, tiny part because it was attached to a blood vessel, and one wrong move could have paralyzed her permanently. Emma has recovered so well that even the doctors seem a bit surprised. We're most likely going home tomorrow. At this point, I'm hoping there is a God, and that the power of prayer is what kept my little Emma safe and well. We had people all over the country praying for us. I hope that everyone will continue praying that the tumor will not come back, and we can walk away from this. All my life, I have been on the fence about God's existence. The hope He does exist and hears our prayers is something I think everyone has in them. To find out my 6-month-old daughter had a tumor, cancerous or not, just put me right back to the part of me that says if God existed, bad things wouldn't happen. I want to take her surgery going well and the good news we have received so far as a sign He does exist. But I also don't want to assume such a large thing from what might be a coincidence. Whether He is there or not, or whether or not the prayers really work, I will keep praying for her speedy recovery, and I hope all of your readers will join us in praying for Emma and all the children here at Eggleston and everywhere else who go through such sad things early in life. Feel free to post our names and locations. It won't bother me at all. I hope you will still run my letter. I would love to read what you have to say about the existence of God. I can't decide if I should take a leap of faith and believe since Emma is okay and attribute it to God. Thank you for thinking of us. Abby. Dear Abby, I know everyone reading these words shares my relief that Emma came through her surgery so well. I'm sorry you've had to endure such a frightful experience. I hope that the worst of it is over, and that you will be able to walk away from this, as you put it, and to keep walking, far and fast, into a future that doesn't contain the words tumor and surgery and cancer. I agonized about whether to publish your letter. Not because it isn't worthy of a reply. Your situation is as serious as it gets, and your doubts about your faith in God are profound and shared by many. But I couldn't help but wonder who the hell I thought I was in daring to address your question. I wonder that often while writing this column, but I wondered it harder when it came to your letter. I'm not a chaplain. I don't know squat about God. I don't even believe in God. And I believe less in speaking of God in a public forum where I'm very likely to be hammered for my beliefs. Yet here I am because there I was, finding it impossible to get your letter out of my head. Nearly 2 years ago, I took my children to the Christmas pageant at the big Unitarian church in our city. The pageant was to be a reenactment of the birth of Jesus. I took my kids as a way to begin to educate them about the non-Santa history of the holiday. Not as religious indoctrination, but as a history lesson. "Who is Jesus?" they asked from the back seat of the car as we drove to the show, after I'd explained to them what we were about to see. They were 4 and nearly 6 at the time. They'd heard about Jesus in glimmers before, but now they wanted to know everything. I wasn't terribly literate in Jesus. My mother was an ex-Catholic who spurned organized religion in her adult life, so I had no religious schooling as a child. But I knew enough that I was able to cover the basics. From his birth in a manger to his young adulthood as a proselytizer for compassion, forgiveness, and love, to his crucifixion and beyond, to the religion that was founded on the belief that Jesus, after suffering for our sins, rose from the dead and ascended to heaven. After I finished with my narration, It was like someone had served my kids 2 triple-shot Americanos. "Tell me about Jesus," became a 10-times-a-day demand. They weren't interested in his birth in the barn, or his philosophies about how to live, or even what he might be up to in heaven. They wanted only to know about his death, in excruciating detail, over and over again, until every ugly fact sank into their precious bones. For months, I was compelled to repeatedly describe precisely how Jesus was flagellated, humiliated, crowned with thorns, and nailed at the hands and feet to a wooden cross to die an agonizing death. Sometimes I would do this while making my way in a harried fashion up and down the aisles of the hoity-toity organic grocery store where we shop, and people would turn and stare at me. My children were both horrified and enthralled by Jesus's crucifixion. It was the most appalling thing they'd ever heard. They didn't understand the story within its religious context. They perceived only its brutal truth. They did not contemplate Jesus's divinity, but rather his humanity. They had little interest in this business about him rising from the dead. He was not to them a Messiah. He was only a man. One who'd been nailed to a cross alive and endured it a good while. "Did it hurt his feelings when they were so mean to him?" my son repeatedly asked. "Where was his mommy?" my daughter wanted to know. After I told them about Jesus's death, I wondered whether I should have. Mr. Sugar and I had managed to shield them from almost all of the world's cruelty by then. So why, for the love of God, was I exposing them to this? Yet I also realized they had to know. Their fascination with Jesus's agony was proof of that. I'd hit a nerve. I'd revealed a truth they were ready to know. Not about Christianity, but about the human condition, that suffering is part of life. I know that. You know that. I don't know why we forget it when something truly awful happens to us, but we do. We wonder, why me? And how can this be? And what terrible God would do this? And the very fact that this has been done to me is proof that there is no God. We act as if we don't know that awful things happen to all sorts of people every second of every day, and the only thing that's changed about the world or the existence or non-existence of God or the color of the sky is that the awful thing is happening to us. It's no surprise you have such doubt in this moment of crisis, sweet pea. It's perfectly natural that you feel angry and scared and betrayed by a God you want to believe will take mercy on you by protecting those dearest to you. When I learned my mom was going to die of cancer at the age of 45, I felt the same way. I didn't even believe in God, but I still felt that he owed me something. I had the gall to think, how dare he? I couldn't help myself. I'm a selfish brute. I wanted what I wanted, and I expected it to be given to me by a God in whom I had no faith. Because mercy had always more or less been granted me, I assumed it always would be. But it wasn't. It wasn't granted to my friend whose 18-year-old daughter was killed by a drunk driver, either. Nor was it granted to my other friend who learned her baby is going to die of a genetic disorder in the not-distant future. Nor was it granted to my former student whose mother was murdered by her father before he killed himself. It was not granted to all those people who were in the wrong place at the wrong time when they came up against the wrong virus or military operation or famine or carcinogenic or genetic mutation or natural disaster or maniac. Countless people have been devastated for reasons that cannot be explained or justified in spiritual terms. To do as you are doing and asking, if there were a God, why would he let my little girl have to have possibly life-threatening surgery? Understandable as that question is, creates a false hierarchy of the blessed and the damned. To use our individual good or bad luck as a litmus test to determine whether or not God exists constructs an illogical dichotomy that reduces our capacity for true compassion. It implies a pious quid pro quo that defies history, reality, ethics, and reason. It fails to acknowledge that the other half of rising, the very half that makes rising necessary, is having first been nailed to the cross.